I probably ought to take a second to give a little more formal introduction. Dr. Joy is a professor of human development and Christian education at Asbury Theological Seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky. His newest book is called Bonding, Relationships in the Image of God. Don, you really talked about some of your early ideas about this book when you were here before, and you went on to put it in writing, didn't you?
Well, I'd have to say it was your excitement and your listeners' excitement that caused me to really try to put together several things that are all related to this matter of basic life intimacies and pair bonding of the love relationship between a man and a woman. All really, I think, are on a continuum.
I want to kind of build on that today. So I think you ought to take just a couple of minutes to provide a definition of what you mean by bonding.
When I talk about bonding as a general term, I want to use it to refer to all human relationships based on intimacy, largely grounded in touch, eye contact, and close proximity, such that the two become one. This often happens in a family. The parent-child relationship is much like that, because it overrides feelings of alienation, it overrides problems of illness, and parents who are bonded to their children, families that are bonded to each other, stick by each other through thick and thin, even through conflict, and they basically are committed to one another. In the marital relationship, it shows up in the fact that, you know, you never wonder when Shirley's going to go home. You never want to be separated from her. You have to be from time to time, but there's a sense that you always know that when the two of you are where you really most want to be, it's together. That's
right.
A sign of bonding. Whereas, you know, to say that marriage is a contract is a terrible level on which marriage might exist.
Now, even in your answer there, you extended the discussion before, because we were talking about romantic relationships and the bonding between a husband and wife, but you implied just now that bonding can occur between groups, families, within families, parent to child, all kinds of other relationships other than that primary sexual relationship.
Yes, I think so. In fact, I've concluded that intimacy in interpersonal relationships is programmed into the human. We all need touch. You've had guests who talk about skin hunger, and all of us need to be touched. I think that hunger is built into us to drive us into significant relationships, and that all the gestures we make toward one another in friendships and in the ultimate intimacy of a marriage are rehearsal for that ultimate reunion of the God-human relationship for which we wait, and which is represented at the end of Revelation as a marriage supper at which there's going to be some kind of a corporate marital bonding in which Christ the bride and Christ the groom, that last Adam, are going to be made one again.
Have you ever met anybody that wasn't bonded with anybody? And if so, how commonly does that occur?
Well, Emancil Patterson helps me to understand in his description of the psychosocial kinship network that people who do not have a minimum of about 20 significant mutually reciprocal, respect-filled relationships tends either to move into a neurotic pattern in which they're self-centered or a psychotic pattern in which they're disoriented. And I suspect that the problem of aging, for example, is that one's friends are dying and that one is more and more alone in the world and loses touch with reality. We really need other people to help us process experience.
But it seems to me there are very few of us that have that many, have 20 significant relationships. I mean, we're fortunate if we find one good friend.
Well, when he describes it, I have my students draw a grid. I called it your handheld trampoline. And I tell them...
That's in your book.
That's right, in chapter one. I tell them, you know, let's, for our purposes, this is not what Patterson suggests, but let's imagine that you've got four groups of people holding a trampoline. It has no frame. And you're out there going to jump. When you need to cry, you need people to support you. When you need to celebrate, you need people to rejoice with you. So take the high and the low moments, and who are the people who are there? And he suggests that those four identifiable groups are your first-degree relatives, which would be father, mother, your own sibling, or your own child, or your spouse. And then on the other end are your second- and third-degree relatives, which are cousins, uncles, grandparents. Now, most of us have that, unless one end of that may have died off, or maybe we're an only child and we don't have that. On the other two sides, though, are the more peer-oriented relationships, one side from the workplace, clubs, church, recreation, And the other final side is the lifelong collection of people that we just don't let go of, and they don't let go of us. So it isn't hard to come up with 20. The tough thing is to apply his five criteria to this trampoline to see whether or not you can still keep a minimum of about 20 people around there. And those are the really tough tests, but they're not impossible.
Well, let me go back to my question.
Sure.
How commonly do you find people who have great difficulty bonding? They just don't feel loved by anybody. They don't feel that they are intimate with anybody. Even in the husband and wife relationship, there is no sense of closeness and romantic love, and they go through life isolated from that kind of very close heart-to-heart touch.
There are a lot of people who feel lonely. I just think if we wanted to spend a half hour talking about the plague of the human race, it's a feeling of isolation. The fact is, most of us have resources for solving that problem, but sometimes we get so depressed that we aren't very nice to be around, and so we really, unless there's somebody to treat us like a basket case, we're out of significant contact with other people. The great source for significant relationships is the church. You know, I wouldn't want to try to exist without being in a Sunday school class or a prayer fellowship or a cell group of some kind in which I could truly tell the truth about myself. I was facing a physical exam, you know. Every once in a while you go to your internist and have that complete examination for which you'd pay money not to have it go through the
I hate that day worse than any day of the year.
All the most undignified things happen to you. And I realized that I could come back from my internist with bad news. Anybody in his 40s or 50s wonders about that. And I asked myself, who could I tell? I decided, you'll be surprised at this, I decided I could not put it on the prayer chain from the church so that everybody would know about it. Mm-hmm. I just am not that kind of a person. I could not stand up in the midweek prayer hour and announce that I had an incurable disease.
Although some do.
Some do, and I respect that. You know, I just think it's wonderful that people can let everyone know instantly where they are. But I decided I could not do that. I was then meeting with five students for lunch 4 days a week. We just carried brown bags and ate together. And I knew immediately who I would tell. And my wife would know, my first degree relatives would know, and those five guys would know with whom I was laughing and praying on a daily basis. But without that kind of a support network, I think any of us is likely to kind of lose their balance. And it's no wonder that psychiatry invents terms like neurotic and psychotic to describe people who are out of balance and don't have a perspective on what's really going on.
Don, in the foreword to this book, you talk about the fact that God intended for there to be complete bonding between him and us, and that got interfered with in the fall, and that our search for meaning in other people is kind of a desperation to restore that lost relationship with God.
It's a yearning to be back home, yeah. you might say, in another sense.
Do we all have that kind of yearning? Is that universal in human nature?
I suspect it's universal. Most people don't know what it is, but they have a hunger for God. I think it was Pascal who said, there's a God-shaped vacuum at the heart of every person, which cannot be satisfied by any created thing, but only by God himself. But, Jim, one of the things that grieves me is that in the religious world, we have put a vertical relationship between God and the humans, and we hear more about sovereignty and the distance of God from the human than anything else. I suspect that comes out of a certain period in history when the major theologians were doing their work, and they were doing it in a monarchical environment, and so that crept in. But the fact is, the doctrine of creation begins with an intimate God who walks with the humans on their level in the cool of the day. And that relationship is characterized by closeness, conversation, affection, trust. And the great tragedy of the original sin is that it broke the trust. And the great mark of it is the grief of God at the separation of the humans from that. Jesus came to tell us the same thing and helps us to call God Father. And from that point on, these are really family metaphors. Isn't that interesting? Uh-huh. On focus on the family. Let's remember that the original paradigm for that is the God-human relationship.
All right, let's take that theoretical model now, and let's bring that down to very practical terms, and let's talk about it in several contexts, and begin with the parent-child relationship. How does a parent bond with a child? I have seen, and I'm sure you have too, situations where the parents love their kids but never felt close to a particular child. Some are easier to bond with than others. Some are just difficult to bond with. How do you assure that? How do you ensure it?
Let's start with the toughest thing, you know, and we want to grieve over this, but it evidently is a fact, there's good documentation for it, that premature babies are often abused children. And the speculation is that the separation of that infant from both parents to put them in intensive child infant care for several weeks many times creates a gap between the parent and the child that really no one could have controlled, surely couldn't have bridged that. Today, you know, it's a great thing that we see them bringing the mother or the father in to have them stroke the child, touch the child, and all of that. There's no question that we need skin contact in the first 2 hours of life to establish that first layer of trust and attachment so that we can overlook the inconvenience of being a parent, we can overlook the interruptions of an infant, and we can be more attached to them than to feel that they're somehow an intruder or a stranger.
The very first time I heard your name was in that context. Somebody sent me a tape where you had been speaking on birth bonding. And so really you've just expanded that through the years to talk about bonding between husband and wife and bonding within the family and outside of it as well.
I was not aware then, as I am now, that most of us learn patterns of intimacy in our own infancy. And so if our parents have touched us, cradled us, cuddled us, if we've experienced infant intimacy and childhood intimacy, we're going to be much better lovers and we're going to be more relaxed and have a larger repertory of relating skills with our spouses.
All right, let's suppose that was missed. And the parent now has a 7-year-old son who's just difficult to love, and the mother or father feels that the bonding has not taken place. Is there hope?
Oh, there surely is. And I've even recommended in adoptive situations and where the child is with the natural mother but a second father, I've recommended that they clock themselves by the hour. I told one young man in Texas, I said, you know, why don't you bring Carlton right up next to you during the 6 o'clock news and get some warmth between your two bodies, just sit there with your arm around him watching the news and do that by the clock. Within a year, there was a transformation in the boy's behavior. He had said to me, that father said, you know, it's really kind of tough to cuddle him when I'm having to get after him so much.
Mm. Just skin time.
Just skin time. Hmm. I said, is there one morning a week you can sleep in after he's awake? Can you get him in bed between you and his mother and just let him feel the warmth of both of you and know that he's important to you? And so they did it by the clock until it became natural.
Hmm.
So it's just critical, I think, that we go back and try to establish that kind of bonding.
It really is true, Don. I was telling you earlier that I recently took Ryan on a hunting trip for several days, and that drew us together in ways that were reminiscent of my relationship with my own father and what those trips did for him and me. Mm-hmm. But one of the characteristics of Ryan in the days after that trip was that he could hardly pass through the room where I was without coming over and hugging me.
Yeah, without touching you.
Yeah. When you feel close to somebody, you want to touch them, and you want to be touched by them.
I was reared in a home in which I have no memory of my father hugging me. There was never any question that he loved me, and he touched me very often. We would go to milk the cows early in the morning, before daylight. I was 6 years old. I should say my younger brother, who was 14 years younger, didn't have to get up to help with the early morning milking, but my dad liked to have me with him. You know, I was his little buddy. So here I was on sub-zero days, wagging my way to the barnyard. My dad would kick me in the seat of the pants with a flat foot. Huh. That was his affection. That was his touch.
And Did you interpret it that way?
Oh, sure. I always knew that because he never hurt me, and there was always something playful going on. I think there are many men who are not comfortable with hugging in our culture. I miss the Russians at the Olympics. Because they always go cheek to cheek whenever there's
sure
a victory. And I think when Jesus breathed on the disciples in John chapter 20, he did it just like that. And many of us men are uncomfortable with that. The first time I hugged my dad, as far as I can remember, was when I was about 35 years old, and it felt like I was hugging an ironing board. He didn't know what to do with that. He's gotten much better at it since then. But that really isn't in the male repertory in much of American male population.
It should be.
But still his touch was there. He was always punching me in the shoulder. I remember it sometimes hurt, But if he really liked something I did or thought something I said was funny, he'd always sock me in the shoulder. Right. Well, that's the same as a hug. It really says, you're a cool guy, and I'm glad I'm your dad. So there was a lot of warmth in that, even though it was not what we would call traditional gestures of affection.
My mind's kind of running along in front of this conversation. The opposite of that is also true, isn't it? When a 13-year-old goes into the rebellion of adolescence, one of the first things they do is pull back from your touch.
I think that's right.
Yeah. You know, you put your arm around them as you always have, and there's a shrinking backwards.
Do you know what I think that also is? A kid about the onset of pubescence knows that they're going to start touching somebody else. And they need some space for their own identity to form itself as an adult. And they're in a lonely spot, and that's why I think they're ready now to start building what they will think is a new set of relationships. The relationship between your 14-year-old son and some fine young gal that he's spotted and he thinks she's pretty nice. He's not going to touch her for a long time, but he's going to starve himself for a few years so that that seems like it's brand new. And a kid can often look at parents and think, I wonder if they're really in love. Because he's feeling such strong things. But the fact is, it's a high compliment to the parents because you touched him when he was little and taught him all those skills, which he's now going to start all over again in the bonding pattern with his life's mate.
Isn't that interesting? I hadn't thought of it in that context, but there is that that period of abstinence from touch very frequently, especially in the strong-willed youngster who will go into the bedroom and close the door and not only pull back from the touch, but actually isolate themselves from
sense
from
of privacy.
And you see that as a preparation for an intimacy.
Very much. You see, that's accompanied by the need for privacy in the bathroom, the locked door, and the endless hours in front of the mirror. And what we now know in terms of brain research is that this kid's brain has not completed the myelinization of the central cortex until about 15 to 17 there. And the big question is, how much value do I have? Am I worth loving? Does God want anything special from me? And how can I possibly face all the responsibilities of being the adult that I know that I want to become? Those are terrifying questions.
What do you say to parents who are frustrated by this alienation? They didn't design it. They didn't want it. But the child suddenly pulls back from their touch. Should they be insulted by it? Should they be frightened by it? Will the bonding reappear at some point down the road?
I'm setting
you up, obviously.
Oh, sure. Well, they can wait for that. And one of the nicer things to see is a child who is really wrestling with this identity and the need for privacy. And the parent simply needs to know they're going to come out of that and they're going to be ready to move without a whole lot of rehearsal for that because they're already programmed for it by their early experience. But what do you do for them? My impression is that it needs to be affirmed. And one of the things I learned from Elmer Galkey's book, You Can Have a Family Where Everybody Wins, is this marvelous thing that the first principle in child rearing is to learn to weep with those who weep and rejoice with those who rejoice. And if a kid needs privacy, we need to find some way to give them that privacy. They need responsibility, of course, too. One of the most terrifying things that ever was told to me by a minister who told how his wife found the door, the bedroom door, of their 13-year-old son locked after school. And she knocked on the door and said, may I come in? And he said, just a minute. But it was locked. She tried it. And so when he wasn't coming to the door, she got the key from above the door facing and opened it. And he fell over his desk, grabbed the top of his desk, and locked it after he had shoved some things in the drawer. She grabbed a hold of him, threw him and the desk and the chair back in the middle of the room, thinking he was into drugs or some terrible thing. And when she went through the mangled mess of what was there, she found that he was making her a Mother's Day card. And that pastor told me it took 15 years for that five-minute episode to be finally worked through between mother and son. And he said, I'm not sure it ever will be what it might have been if she had trusted him with some privacy. So the need for privacy is right.
Yeah, it is, Don. The other half of that is what Carol Burnett said when she discovered her daughter had been on drugs and she had been trusting her. And she said, don't trust them. You got a right to know. You better find out. And if they pull behind that cloak and you think something's going on that's hurting them, you better invade the privacy. And I'm inclined to agree with that, too.
Well, let me take you back to bonding. How do you know when Shirley's telling the truth? You look her in the eye.
That's right, between the eyes, right.
And you don't have to invade her room and do an illegal search. All you need to do is put your hands on the shoulders of the kid and say, you know how much I'm committed to you, and I really want to see you launched as a responsible adult, and I want to ask you some questions. And don't you look the other way. And the eyes can never lie.
That's
so
true.
So bonding tells the truth in a couple relationship or in a parent-child relationship. So, and that brings intimacy, too, because if you're standing there, you're both going to be in tears before it's over with. But the truth is the bottom line, and it's got to always be there. So I don't think these are contradictory, but it's a matter of strategy and how we use intimacy and the respect for privacy to go hand in hand so that we can keep the trust relationship.
All right, in the interest of time, let's talk about bonding between siblings. You know, there's a classic warfare that occurs between daughters and sons, or sons and sons and daughters and daughters. Is there a way to get them to bond to one another, or is that a long-term project and you can't expect it when they're young?
Jim, you're the authority on that.
I'd like it's to bat- your fun sitting here putting you on the
horse. I'd like to bat that one back in your court. I can tell you what I've observed. I've observed that where there are rituals of family relationships, we hold hands at our table, for example. You can't take 4 square inches of skin in each hand around the table for 10 or 12 or 15 years without sensing some responsibility for that person at prayer. I just think there's nothing like prayer and bonding of the skin in your hands that says we are really a solid group here. There are a lot of things to do. We did some of this around the table at our house when our boys were in conflict. We had a Cain and Abel scene one day in which we had blood on the floor. And it was a terrifying kind of thing because there's potential conflict, competition, all that sort of thing. And it's just...
What were their ages?
They're 4 years apart, and the violence erupted at about 8 and 12. And the older one struck the younger one and brought the blood out of the head, so we had to have some stitches in the head. Well, that's a piece of violence that's typical, I think, in any family. But one of the things we always did was to bring them right back together around the mealtime or wherever we were, and we were simply building the sense that we are responsible for each other. Until we saw a playback of that shortly after that episode in which a neighbor boy threw a snowball with an embedded piece of limestone in it. I hope it was an accident. At the time, we didn't make any speculations other than that it was an accidental scoop up of a chunk of stone in a handful of snow. But it required even more stitches. And here was the younger brother who was left standing outside screaming bloody murder. And the neighbor boy's father came over to say, Mike, he's going to be all right. We're going to take him to the doctor. He'll be all right. Mike said, I know. But David hit Goliath in the head with the stone, and he died. And you've killed my brother.
Oh, my.
So there was an enormous attachment.
Yeah. Don, there seems to be a great contradiction there between the competition that kids feel for the parents' affection and so on, and this kind of bonding that you're talking about. Can they coexist?
They surely must. It may be that love and hate are on a continuum, and that the task of the home is to move things toward respect and not violence. It's pretty clear from the homicide statistics that you're much more likely to be murdered by a member of your own family than by a total stranger.
Mm-hmm.
And when a prominent American evangelist's wife was being interviewed about whether or not she'd ever thought of divorcing her husband, she said, no, but I've thought of murder. It's that kind of a continuum, I think, that if you really love someone, then you're much more likely to do something violent.
The opposite of love is not hate, but passiveness.
I think that'd be right, or indifference.
Yeah, the person that you see on the street that you don't even know is at the other end of the continuum from love, not hatred. You got to feel something for somebody in order to love or hate them.
I've observed that the people who are most vocal in terms of obscenities are also the people who, if they were converted to Christ, could be the most vocal in the celebration. That is, the affect is either negative or positive.
Don, in this book, Bonding Relationships in the Image of God, give me, in a summary statement here at the end of the broadcast, what you most want to convey with this new book. What one message stands out above all the others?
Every human is created to represent God. We come in two models, male and female, and the image of God is full spectrum in that representation. Every family has one of each, a father and a mother. We're on a lifelong voyage, during which time how we relate to each other as mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, whether it is in a marital or family relationship, or whether it's in the office, wherever there are men and women, they're representing God's character. And ultimately, we're rehearsing for some kind of reunion, a glorious reunion, with God in that God-human relationship, the God whom we represent by being men and women.
You've done it again, Don, and I appreciate your being here to bring your perspectives. Do you read all the time? Where do you come up with your views of life and mankind?
Do you know what I read, Jim? I read a lot of novels. I think I've read all of C.S. Lewis's fiction. My creativity works there, and something like C.S. Lewis does a lot of theological stimulation to me. That drives me back to Scripture. And then I have students who are writing research proposals and who are putting me into the computer summaries of the best research, and I'm always asking the questions of the witnesses, you know, what is it that the creation is saying? What is it saying to Scripture? And so I'm always working, I'm on the hunt for something like that.
Well, we look forward to seeing your book.
Thank you.
And with that, we come to the end of this Focus on the Family cassette. We hope that these discussions have given you insight into ways to encourage and strengthen marital and family relationships. And thank you for listening.